Welcome to the Agricultural Economics Podcast. This is your host, Jessica Eyes, and I'm here with my co-host, Dr. Ken Foster, head of the Agricultural Economics Department here at Purdue University. How are you, Ken?
I'm doing great, Jessica. This is the Thursday before the Snyder Memorial Lecture.
What's that?
Well, years ago, Jim Snyder was a faculty member in agricultural economics here at Purdue, and his untimely death has been memorialized by this lecture, where we endeavor to bring back somebody to the Purdue campus to talk to our students and faculty, get them excited about the things that we do, and maybe help them see new opportunities for things that we could do.
And who's our guest this year, Ken?
Oh, you know what? Our guest this year is a very special guest because his name is Dr. Robert Thompson, but where he's special to me is that he was the dean at Purdue when I was hired. So he's the guy who started it all. Isn't that something?
I didn't know that.
That's right.
Yeah. I remember the toughest question in my interview was, I think he asked me something about, you know, what would I do to help farmers if I came to Purdue? And I think what I said is I'd probably just go out and help them bale hay. But anyway, welcome, Bob. We're so happy to have you here with us.
This is our guest.
It's great to be back on campus. You know, Purdue's a very special place for both my wife and me. Between us, we have four Purdue degrees and our son the fifth. But Purdue was good to me as a graduate student in the late 60s and a PhD student in the early 70s. And then as a faculty member and as an administrator when I was dean. And so Purdue is a very special place. We raised our children in West Lafayette. They definitely view themselves as Hoosiers. So it's great to be back. I'm really proud to be invited to give the Snyder Lecture.
And I understand that you knew Professor Snyder, is that right?
I did. I took his course in linear programming. I would have taken it about 1968. I was a PhD student the semester I remember when he passed away. I remember very clearly. It was just a tragic loss to have somebody who was such a distinguished teacher, who was really pushing the frontiers of applying quantitative methods, particularly linear programming, to agribusiness management issues.
Now, what are you going to talk about tomorrow during the lecture?
Well, I'm going to talk about the changing geopolitics of agriculture. When we look at where the demand growth is occurring and where the supply potential is for agricultural products around the world, we find a significant mismatch. The two regions that are growing the most are South Asia and Sub-Saharan Africa. Well, first you look at East Asia and South Asia, more than twice as much of the world's population than of the arable land. Population growing at a pretty rapid rate in South Asia, and there's just no scenario I can construe in which those two regions can possibly be self-sufficient in their food supply. Then the Middle East and North Africa, they've got plenty of land, but it's water they lack, so I would add them in the same category. But then we have Sub-Saharan Africa, the only region of the world projected to more than double its population in the next 35 years, less than 1 billion people today and projected to go to over 2 billion by mid-century. Demand for food is exploding in Sub-Saharan Africa. As a result of the population growth, reinforced by rapid urbanization, further reinforced by broad-based economic growth in some countries, it's reducing poverty, empowering the low-income people for the first time to be able to consume some animal protein, more fruits, vegetables, edible oils, dairy products. We're seeing a set of forces driving an increasing fraction of world agricultural production moving through international markets. Then we overlay that with climate change, in which all agroecosystems around the world are shifting. Generally, you can think in terms of agroecosystems sliding 3, 4, 5 degrees latitude further north in the northern hemisphere and south in the southern hemisphere, which are likely to significantly alter the comparative advantage of different regions. Like, for example, I think the Canadian prairies will probably be the largest single beneficiary in agriculture of climate change worldwide, because when you're talking about 1 or 2 degree increase in temperature of the world average temperature, we know that the warming is greater over land than over water, and greatest at the poles relative to the equator. So we may have an 8 degree increase in average temperature out in the Canadian prairies and in Siberia. And so we're increasing the available land in those areas. So between the mismatch between resources and demand growth and the effects of climate change, we're going to see a larger fraction of world agricultural production move through international markets. And then I'll get into talking about policy issues, how we seem to be entering a period of rising protectionism, which flies in the face of exactly what we need, the opposite, for trade to be the great balancing wheel, as we have extreme weather conditions in some parts of the world hurt crops, and very favorable weather conditions in other parts favor high productivity, and then switching around from year to year, we're going to need the international markets to be the great balancing wheel in international agriculture.
So it sounds like a lot of this comes down to policy and economics. We hear lots of things about 9 billion people by 2050 and the pressures on food supply and food security. What's your overall outlook? Where do you think we're going? What's the future hold for us?
We've recently come off a period of about 150 years of a slight negative trend in the real price of agricultural commodities. You know, Malthus was wrong when he wrote his famous book in the late 19th century, when he predicted that population growth would outstrip the planet's food production capacity, and that starvation would ultimately limit the size of the world's population. Well, Malthus has been wrong for more than two centuries now, because he underestimated the power of investments in agriculture research to raise productivity slightly faster than global demand for food rose, which is what gave us the slight negative trend in prices. Now, as we look out through the 21st century, I see no more reason for Malthus to be right in the 21st century than he was in the 19th or 20th, but he'll only continue to be wrong if we invest enough in agriculture research to raise productivity at least as fast as the demand is growing from population growth, urbanization, and income growth. And at the moment, we've been going the other direction in support for agriculture research. Instead of increasing the support for international agriculture research, we've been cutting it. Foreign aid going to agriculture and rural development fell off the cliff in the mid-1980s, went into precipitous decline. The fraction going to ag research declined even more so, proportionally more so. There's been a little bit of a turnaround recently, but we have very low commodity prices today, and I think it's going to be difficult to keep priority in agriculture development back on the global agenda. I think we're too prone to abstract from the price of the moment in projecting forward. In 2008, 2011, when we had high prices, a lot of people just saw these high prices continuing right on through the 21st century. Now we're getting the opposite. Now that we're in the epoch of low prices, people are projecting out as if we're never going to see high prices again. Mm-hmm. These are still commodity markets. Regardless of what the long-term trend is, up, down, or flat, we will have years of high prices, we will have years of low prices, and perhaps because climate change is giving us more frequent extreme climatic events, we probably should be expecting greater variability of commodity prices in the future than we have today.
Mm-hmm. So this agricultural research, do you see the private sector stepping in where the public sector has maybe withdrawn?
The private sector has picked up a lot of the slack in the high-income countries. Basically, the private sector will address the most economically costly problems of the most economically important crops of the rich countries. Because obviously, if the private sector is going to do the agriculture research, they have to protect the intellectual property that results from the research and have to embody it in something that farmers have to buy every year as inputs in order to recover the cost of investment and provide a return to their shareholders. Private sector will be very responsive to the most economically costly problems of the most economically important crops, but we can't expect them to solve all the problems of low-income country agriculture. And of course, that's where 90% or 95% of the growth in demand is going to be. It's going to be in poor countries. Poor countries that are undergoing both population growth, urbanization, but also broad-based economic development that lifts the maximum number of people out of their poverty. Those are my thoughts on that topic.
Sounds like a great plug for Purdue Ag Econ's International Development Program and International Trade Programs. And hopefully some potential students are listening and they might come here to study.
Dr. Thompson, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to join us for this podcast. It's great that you came all the way out here from D.C. We really appreciate it.
Thanks very much for having me.
Yep, of course. You've been listening to the Agricultural Economics Podcast in the Department of Agricultural Economics at Purdue University. Thank you for listening, and you can follow us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter, or you can check us out on our webpage
at www.agecon.purdue.edu.
Thank you.